Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. 33 million Americans are now 65 and older by 2030. That number is expected to reach nearly 70 million. Sister Joan Chittister is an internationally renowned author and lecturer. She's known as one of the most influential spiritual leaders of our time. She's written more than 50 books, and she's executive director of Bennett Vision, a resource and research center for contemporary spirituality. She's a member of the Benedictine Sisters of Erie, Pennsylvania. She's coming to South Dakota this month for the Aging Faithfully Conference at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. But first, we want to welcome her to Dakota Midday. Sister Joan, welcome.
Well, thank you, Lori. I'm happy for this conversation, actually.
I'm happy to get to know you a little bit better beyond what I have read in your many books. I want to start with this idea of thinking as you get older. Have you become a deeper thinker? Has the way that you think changed as you have aged?
It does, as a matter of fact. We brought with us into this period a number of conventional truisms that are, frankly, more stereotypes than they are facts. We know now, for instance, let's just put it this way, Lori. There was a time when, in fact, at this point, we know everything. We can chart the development gestures of an infant. We know every developmental period, role, behavior from the moment of birth until 21 years old. And yet, the whole period or phase or dimension of the elderly, the gerontology, the study of elder development isn't even a science. It isn't even a phase of secular learning until after World War II. It begins then. So the point is that we're finding things out now that completely reverse what we thought we knew. We know now, for instance, that despite what we were told when I was 20, that the human brain began to, in essence, deteriorate after at the age of 30. And then by the time, it would simply progressively deteriorate through your lifetime. And certainly by it would be totally dysfunctional by the age of 80. And yet, gerontology and neurology now indicate to us this is not just unusual, this is false. We discover at this point that the human mind does not deteriorate at all. We can be as intellectually competent at the age of 80 as we were at the age of 40. But as you've indicated, Laurie, we begin to process data differently. The elder brain absorbs factual data and does it with great facility. But by the time a person is older, from 60 to 65 on, we know so many facts. We know so many things. We've had so much experience that it's no longer what we remember, but the way we put it together that determines our own function in society. That's a big piece of understanding, because we have people here in a country that, incidentally, has one of the higher median ages of the Western world. We have people who are listening to this program who, at the age of 55 or 60, are beginning to feel for the later years of their lives. It's a frightening thing as far as I'm concerned. Why? Because it means that if that keeps up, we're about to lose one-third of the resources of this country.
Do you see a shift in as we get more information about the brain, for example, as you mentioned, aging, and that news is very positive and good, do you see a concurrent shift in our social attitudes towards people in elder years?
Oh, well, you mean, yes, the social norms are not changing as fast as the neurology ought to require. Our ads on television are stuck in a pre-gerontology age. I mean, we are youth-centered to the point that it's hard to believe that anybody older has any interest whatsoever except insurance. In fact, if you begin to watch the talk shows, for instance, on American television on Sunday morning, when they're dealing with serious issues, who are the people they're looking for? Who are the people who are bringing together for us as we try to make our way through this cultural, political imperative that we're living in? These are older, experienced people who bring their wisdom to bear on their experience and their experience to filter out the facts.
I'm wondering if you might have thoughts about the distinctions between how we see men and aging and how we see women aging.
Well, those studies are getting better. I thank you for making the important distinction. Gerontology now seems, as far as I can follow the data, relatively gender-free. But at the same time, our longevity studies are limited. And the most important one and the longest-running one is the Valiant study out of Harvard. And it begins by studying 20-year-old undergraduates in Harvard and then follows them all the way through life. And only later did they add a woman's section. So those that data, I fear, is not as fine-tuned as it ought to be. And yet, at the same time, I don't want to discount that data. It is, after all, studying the human brain and its developmental stages. So it would seem to me that given the fact that women, by and large, live longer than men do, then you'll see even more data on the acuity factor, which, as far as we can tell, is not diminishing at all, except for people in chronic illness. Now, if you're talking about early onset Alzheimer's, for instance, well, then of course, but that's illness. You have to understand that the average American adult does not spend more than 3 months before death in any kind of a special care facility. That means we're healthy until the end. Our mind, our brain is functioning right to the end of life. What's that telling us? That's telling us that life is good all the way to the end. There's only one caveat there, and that is the brain stays plastic and functional provided you keep using it. Now, the analogy for there is, of course, not equivalent, but it is similar. If you stop using your knees, I promise you, your knees will stop being able to be used at a very early age. They'll simply lock up. If you do not engage in lifelong learning, if you take the attitude that we were sold years ago, that, as a matter of fact, you're not capable of learning anything new, then the mind will begin to close down. You'll no longer be exercising its qualities or capacities. So what that boils down to is it's your choice. You can decide how long you want to be intellectually acute. By maintaining the facility that you have built or that you will increasingly build as time goes on. You're 65. What do you want to learn? Huh. You've always wanted to be a woodworker? Terrific. Get a book. You're 65. What do you want to learn? You always wish you could play a guitar? Buy a guitar. You have to decide, in other words, how intently you will allow your brain to live as your body lives around it.
I'm wondering if there's things that, as a society, we need to change our mindset to really tap into the resource of that wisdom and that growth in knowledge over the years.
Well, I have to admit to you, Laurie, that this is, I'll tell you why I wrote this book. I wrote this book because I was the prioress of a Benedictine community of women. Mm-hmm. Now, Benedictinism is the oldest religious order in the Catholic Church. The only institution older than Benedictinism in the Catholic Church, in the institution itself, is Benedictinism, and, or the only institution older than Benedictinism, I mean, is the institution of the church itself. Huh. Now, as the abbess or the prioress of a community, I began to notice that there was definitely a difference among our older people, but I wasn't exactly sure what it was. I knew that they were terribly important to the community, that they never gave up. They never considered themselves useless. Around the monastery, there's always plenty to do, and most of it is intellectual. Hmm. So they came out of one phase of their life, and they had been fourth-grade teachers, and they began to be librarians. They began to be research assistants. They began to be tutors. They began to be researchers themselves. They began to be writers. It was perfectly clear that these older women did not define themselves by the numbers of years they had been alive. So I sat down and began to work on this subject, saying, what is it to be older, and what do we know about old? And when it was done, when all my own research and interviews and work was finished, and I began to look at this, therefore, as a special, and therefore a special spiritual age in human development, it occurred to me, in response to your question, what's going on in society around that either encourages or depresses this development, it's pretty clear to me that this subject is one of the most needed social subjects in our environment. Why? Because there is a gap the size of a football field in our thinking about it. This subject is missing in society. We have become a culture with very limited sense of history. If you try to talk the Korean War in a high school classroom, even a college classroom, that's ancient history. They're not interested in it. A culture with no sense of history is doomed to make decisions that are based on very questionable values in terms of their longevity. If a society like this can develop an addiction to fruitless change. We've done it 5 years. We know that that's old. It's 10 years old, we should get rid of that furniture. We don't need to do this any longer. You've been in that job for 7 years? What are you doing there yet? Oh, I like it. I always wanted to do it. Oh, yeah, well, I mean, you're going to grow into a lump of cement, for heaven's sakes. Think of it. Yeah. What I'm saying is, you can create a society with a dearth of wisdom. If you are not identifying the elders in your society who can bring you not just the historical overview of any given item in this society, like the labor movement, for instance. Mm-hmm. What does this generation know about the labor movement while they themselves are in jobs that are not being justly paid? Mm-hmm. Never occurs to them that they might need a labor union to negotiate with larger anonymous corporations, because they've lost that sense of history. And on top of that, you get an immersion in a youth culture where you have 65-year-old women trying to dress like 22-year-olds because they bought the message. Mm-hmm. They drunk the Kool-Aid. Being 65 in this culture is not desirable. And so you try to hide it with everything in you. And as a result, you lose the sense of the value of your generation, of the richness that it has to give to others, and of the riches that it brings to your own life, when you can live at a different pace, study what you want to study, join the groups that are most enriching to you, and go on learning. Instead, in a society with no sense of the value of this last stage of life, you find yourself in a cauldron of ageism, which makes it impossible for you yourself to become everything you could ever have been.
You have written, and if you're just joining us, you're listening to Sister Joan Chittister, author of more than 50 books, one of which is called The Gift of Years, Growing Older Gracefully. She's coming to the Aging Faithfully Conference at Augustana University in July. Sister Joan, you've written about the stories or the tales of older people in a family becoming the catechism of a family. I just love that. Do you think we put enough emphasis on story in our culture, in our families?
Well, no, actually, and we kind of know that, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't have a lot of family journals, which would be wonderful writing. In fact, I just talked to somebody about 2 months ago who told me that they had cleared out the parents' house. The one spouse had died, the other one was moving into a retirement housing, which is fine, wonderful. But they were getting rid of downsizing, we call it. So I said, that's hard, isn't it? And the answer was, oh, well, it was very interesting. You know, it was hard. Some of it was hard because you remembered it from your childhood. And in fact, she said, I found my mother's, my mother had kept every letter that she sent to my father during the war and every letter he sent back, and they were all in a box upstairs, and they had a big ribbon around them. I said, gosh, what'd you do with those? And she said, oh, we had to throw those away.
Oh, no.
Said, you threw those away? Do you realize that would be an emotional history of a country at war? Oh, well, she said, yeah, but, I mean, you don't know what they might have been talking about. I couldn't believe it. We didn't have room to keep them, and nobody thought to take them to the local library where these people had grown up, where they had gone to school together, been married together, raised their family together, and went through the war together, and this had no sense of meaning, of larger meaning. I thought that Laurie was actually just a profile, an icon, of what happens when you lose a sense of all the stages of life.
Does your soul continue to grow as you get older? Do you believe that?
Oh, I do. I mean, the soul is meant to grow through every stage of life. And in this final, last stage where you have the luxury of reflection and overview and evaluation, when you have the time to reflect both on the past and on the relationship of the past to the present, and on the new questions that have arisen out of what you thought were the solved questions, you now have the luxury of evaluating from your own perspective and experience what you've been through all your life, and even alerting the rest of your family to it. You see old aunts and uncles trying to do that. Nobody's listening. You see grandmothers and grandfathers, and their insights are considered mutterings too much of the time. Until the children themselves get to be 40 or 50, and then all of a sudden, the kind of under the murky presence of the brain emerges these lost memories. My grandmother used to say that. My grandfather showed me how to do that. I had an Uncle Bob who insisted that there was one thing you had to do once a week, and that was take a walk in the woods, because someday those woods weren't going to be there.
What is your reading life like? I have to ask, what is your reading life like? You must be a big reader.
My reading life?
Yeah.
I read 4 books at all times. I read something that's in my own area. I read 2 things that are completely out of my area, something I've always wanted to work with. And I read a good piece of fiction. Hmm. And I do that at all times.
What are you reading right now?
Well, right now I'm reading 4 things. One is Sailing Out of Byzantium. Because I don't know as much about the history of the Middle East and its relationship, especially to the Western Church, as I would like to know. I'm reading a great new book. It's called All of Kitteridge,
uh-huh.
A beautiful piece of American marriage lore that I would recommend to anybody. I'm reading a history of the Western world, and I'm reading a feminist interpretation of the Torah.
Huh. I'm going to be selfish and ask you one more question. You were raised as an only child. I have an only child. What was it like growing up as an only, and what do you bring into your adult life that you learned about being an only child?
Well, I can tell you this much, Lori, with all of the sincerity in my heart, it was wonderful growing. And yes, I lived in a period of the great myth that if you were an only child, something was wrong with you. But furthermore, something was wrong with your parents. Nobody should only have one child. They should have 4 or 5 or 6, and a very minimum of 2 or 3. I realize when I look back, in fact, I was listening to the radio this morning, coming back to the Priory, and they were discussing a very interesting new study on the effect of poverty on what they call non-cognitive skills. And the study discovers that children from more financially secure homes develop a set of social skills like persistence and responsibility, reliability, respect, social conversation, that children from homes that are more stressed do not.
Hmm.
And I listened to it, and I going through a red light almost, I stopped just in time and said to myself, that's it, Joan. That's what being an only child was about.
Hmm.
It meant that you were being mentored every minute of your life breath into an adult society that had its expectations for you as a child, but was building a very early bridge to what it meant to be an adult in that same society.
Mm.
So, Lori, I can only tell you, your child is in good hands with a great future ahead of her, and please promise me you won't worry.
I won't worry. Thank you so much for that. I have enjoyed so much talking with you and listening to you, learning from your books and from your voice. So thank you so much for joining us today. You are invited back anytime.
Well, I'd love it, Lori. Just call. We'll have another good conversation on anything you want. Truly, it's been wonderful. I appreciate your interest in the subject. I know that a lot of your listeners are right in the middle of this thing right now.
Yes.
Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.